TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Oppenheimer and the Bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Paul Jay and Peter Kuznick challenged the claims that the bombing ended World War II. 2 weeks before Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day 2023, Paul Jay and Peter Kuznick had a conversation about the just-released film Oppenheimer by Christopher Nolan. They acknowledged the importance of the film at a time when the risk of a nuclear war is the highest since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. But they also raised the question why it is still possible to claim that the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima saved lives by ending World War II. Thanks to Paul Jay, host and co-founder of TheAnalysis.news, for inviting Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Here's an excerpt from their one-hour conversation that I hope you will watch on YouTube under the title Oppenheimer, U.S.-developed first strike weapon and used Japan to prove it. Here's Paul Jay.
Over the weekend, I saw Christopher Nolan's film, Oppenheimer.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
They have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope. All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here. A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves. And the world is not prepared.
And while it is a fantastic piece of filmmaking, and I encourage everybody to see it, and I applaud everything it does to help encourage a rational and deeper discussion. I shouldn't even say deeper, because there's practically no discussion going on about American and other nuclear weapons policy, nuclear war policy. Still, I think there are some serious issues that need to be discussed about the film. And now joining me to do that is someone who's been studying the issues of nuclear war, nuclear weapons, and American-Japanese relations, and World War II for decades. So now joining me is Peter Kuznick. He's professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Peter is the co-author with Oliver Stone of the Showtime series, The Untold History of the United States. Thanks for joining me, Peter.
Glad to be with you, Paul.
The film is based on the book American Prometheus, and it's written by Kai Bird and Marty Sherwin. Peter knew Marty, who passed away not too long ago, and is a friend of Kai Bird. And I should also say I'm making a film now based on Daniel Ellsberg's book, Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Our film is called How to Stop a Nuclear War. So, Peter, what's your impression of the film?
It's a very complex film. It's a three-hour biopic that offers more information about nuclear history and American politics from the 1940s, actually even before that, 1930s, 1920s. Than almost any other movie I can think of. So it's a very dense film. A lot of attention is paid to certain things. One is the Trinity test. On July 16, 1945, when Oppenheimer and the scientists at Los Alamos did the atomic bomb test of the plutonium bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico, there's a lot about the buildup to that.
This is a matter of life and death. I can perform this miracle. World War II would be over. Our boys would come home.
The world will remember this day.
Our work here will ensure a peace mankind has never seen.
maybe it's a bigger one.
So that's developed very thoroughly. And then there's a lot afterwards about the 1954 Army security hearings in which Oppenheimer loses his security clearance. So that is all done very, very well. There are other things that are left out or elided, and that is unfortunate. The biggest shortcoming is its failure to accurately assess what scientists knew and what others knew before the United States dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. There was quite a bit of controversy, and that does not come across. Nolan, to his credit, raises it, the scientists' opposition to dropping the bomb, three times that I've picked up on, but they are very short, very cryptic, very brief, and if you're not on top of it, you'll miss it. And the final word is always given to Oppenheimer or military people who say that if we don't drop the bomb, we're going to have to invade and America's going to lose, what, 500,000 boys in an invasion. That was the myth. That is the fundamental myth of the atomic bombing that you and I have discussed. The idea that the only way to avoid an American invasion of Japan and fighting against these fanatical Japanese who were preparing to resist and would have cost 500,000 to 1 million to several million American and Japanese lives, that the only way to do that was to drop the bomb. When we know in reality, there were two other major factors that could have ended the war. One was letting the Japanese know that they could keep the emperor, dropping the demand for unconditional surrender. And almost everybody who was an advisor to Truman made that point. We look at Secretary of War Stimson, Admiral Leahy, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, John McCloy. I mean, you could go to almost everybody. The only one, really, who convinced Truman not to change the surrender terms was Jimmy Burns. Jimmy Burns is an anti-Soviet hawk during this period. He comes up. So Truman becomes president on April 12th. Roosevelt dies on April 12th. Truman had been vice president for 82 days. During that time, nobody had enough regard for him, respect for him, to even tell him that the United States was building an atomic bomb. Unbelievable. One of those things in history that's simply mind-blowing. So Truman doesn't know the United States is building an atomic bomb, despite being vice president for 3 months, until after he's sworn in that night. And Stimson mentions it to him, and Truman said, well, I was distracted, I didn't ask him anything. But the next day, Burns flies up, and Burns briefs him more fully on it. And Truman writes in his memoir, Burns called it a weapon great enough to destroy the whole world. He says it may allow us to dictate our terms at the end of the war. You know, not a bigger weapon, not a more powerful weapon, a weapon great enough to destroy the whole world. From the beginning, Truman gets that. He doesn't get a lot of things, but he understands that. And this is not in the movie. But also, the scientists' opposition is not in the movie. There's a little bit. There are snippets. Leo Szilard is in it. There was recently an MSNBC documentary about Oppenheimer. I think it's called To End All Wars. And that just came out a week or two ago. And that is so much worse than the Nolan film. So much more misinformation. In that, they mention the emigre scientists who had escaped from Nazi-occupied Europe. And they list Beta, Teller, Fermi, and Einstein. They don't even mention Leo Szilard. Szilard is crucial. Brilliant Hungarian physicist. Now, we know that the Trinity test takes place on July 16, 1945. 6 years before that, to the day, July 16, 1939, Leo Szilard and another Hungarian physicist emigre, Eugene Wigner, borrowed a car and drove out to Peconic, Long Island, where Albert Einstein was vacationing. Einstein is by far the most famous scientist in the world. They go to see Einstein because they could not get the American authorities interested in the fact that the Germans had split the uranium atom, which meant the theoretical possibility of developing atomic bombs. And the Americans weren't interested. The American scientists were minimally interested. The American military thought, well, a new weapon won't be ready for two wars. And so they couldn't get them interested. So Szilard and Wigner go out to see Einstein, and they brief Einstein. Einstein had been so out of the loop working on his unified field theory that he didn't even know the Germans had split the uranium atom back in late 1938. But he gets it immediately, of course, and he signs the letter to President Roosevelt urging the U.S. to begin the nuclear research program. Einstein later says, I made one great mistake in my life. I have one great regret, writing the letter to President Roosevelt. But there was some justification at that time. The emigres believed that the Germans were a year to 2 years ahead of us. And that's what motivated their frenzy in beginning the project. But the project got off the ground very slowly. And Einstein actually wrote three letters to Roosevelt, although the other two are not really well known. But the project doesn't get off the ground till 42. We don't test the feasibility of a nuclear chain reaction in an atomic pile until Fermi and Szilard do it at the University of Chicago in late 42. And then in 43, Leslie Groves is put in charge building the Manhattan Project and the bomb research project, which really starts in 42. Initially under MetLab at the University of Chicago under Arthur Holly Compton, a Nobel Prize winning physicist who had been a scientific activist, a left-wing activist, along with Oppenheimer in the 1930s. So Compton heads MetLab, and in the summer of 42, he asks Oppenheimer to organize a group of luminaries to go out to Berkeley, the leading physicists, the leading thinkers, go out to Berkeley and think about the implications of this bomb, if we develop it. And Oppenheimer invites Bethe and Teller and Serger and some of the other brilliant physicists at the time. And on the train ride out there, Fermi, Enrico Fermi, had already spoken with Teller about the fusion bomb, which Teller couldn't get out of his mind. And on the train ride from the East Coast to the West Coast, he and Bethe kept talking about this. Then when they get out there, they're doing calculations. And all of a sudden, all the scientists are staring at the blackboard in terror because they realize they put up equations that if they ignite an atomic bomb, it could potentially ignite all the nitrogen in the atmosphere or all the hydrogen in the seas and blow up the world. Now, this is sort of in the movie, which is to Nolan's credit. What happens in the movie is that Oppenheimer then goes and talks to Einstein about it. And Einstein acknowledges that there is the possibility of blowing up the world. Then they go back there. The reality was Oppenheimer went out to Michigan where Arthur Holly Compton was vacationing. And he laid out to Compton what they discovered. And Compton says, very importantly, better live in slavery to the Nazis than bring down the final curtain on mankind. That's, of course, how somebody should react to that. And so they stop the project. Oppenheimer goes back there. Bethe was the best mathematician, and he realized they didn't account for all the heat that and energy that would be absorbed by radiation. They redo the calculations, and they decide that the chance of blowing up the world are 3 in a million. And they decide, well, that's enough of a risk, and that's worth it in order to stop the Nazis. But the thing about the bomb was it was never initially intended as an offensive weapon to be used in the war. It was meant entirely as...
Peter, can I jump in for a second?
Yeah.
Let me jump in, because there's, I think, a key thing you got to add here. When they finally decide it's, quote, near zero, that is atmospheric ignition.
Yes.
And also, just to add a little color to this, one of the reasons Hitler decided not to continue the program is he was afraid of atmospheric ignition. I don't know if it's true or not, but that's what Speer said. But whatever Hitler did, even if chance was near zero, it wasn't zero. But the thing is, they tested after they knew that there was no longer a Nazi bomb. I've seen reports that as early as 1943, British intelligence told the Americans the German plan's going nowhere. They're relying on heavy water. It's not going to work in 44. But the actual test that takes place is actually after the defeat of Hitler. I mean, they know there's no more German bomb. So even if the risk of atmospheric ignition is near zero, why risk it? And then we'll get into the Japanese question. But it's insane that they take the risk when there's no German bomb. And Nolan's film doesn't draw that connection.
No. Nolan doesn't draw that connection. Nolan is worried about this, though. I mean, he does really emphasize that.
I think Nolan starts to think he's Oppenheimer. Like, he has to represent
Yes. The
world as viewed by Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer wanted to test, and he wanted to drop the bombs on Japan.
Yeah, you know, that's the problem. Oppenheimer is the protagonist. He's the focus, and he's the fascinating person. Nolan, in his commentary afterwards, said Oppenheimer was the most important man who ever lived, that he changed the course of history in a way that nobody else could. I would like to ask him if he thinks General Groves was the second most important man who ever lived, and what he would say to that.
Well, how about quoting Truman, say, I'm the one that actually said, use it, make me the most important man. That is in the film.
Yes, that is in the film. In a very, very important scene, when Oppenheimer goes to see him afterwards, what they don't have in the movie is Henry Wallace. They don't have...
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
They don't have the fact that they say that Truman became president on April 12th. I don't know if it's April 12th, but since Truman became president, they don't mention the fact that Wallace had been vice president before Truman, that Wallace was perhaps the leading critic of using the bomb and then of the nuclear arms race, that Wallace was enormously popular, unlike Truman, that July 20th, 1944, the day that the Democratic Party convention began, Gallup released a poll asking potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Wallace back as vice president. 2% said they wanted Truman. Had Wallace been back as vice president, there would have been no atomic bombing in World War II and probably no Cold War. So history could have really been different. And then Nolan...
Yeah, because Wallace wanted the detente, the alliance, to continue after the war. Wallace had access to all the same intelligence. He knew that the Soviet Union, whatever you want to make of the Soviet Union domestically, Wallace and many others in the know knew there was no attempt at global military domination. That was a total crock.
They wanted to work with the United States. They wanted the $20 billion in credits that Roosevelt had floated. They wanted to rebuild their society. They lost 27 million people in the war. They were desperate to rebuild.
Just let me add another piece. When the Americans do find out almost conclusively enough that there's no German nuclear weapons program, Gross doesn't tell the scientists for quite some time because he's afraid they're not going to keep working on the bomb because most of them joined in on it because it was they were fighting Hitler. If it hadn't been for Hitler, they would have created such a weapon.
Exactly. Although some of them get so engaged in the scientific experimentation.
And they do it anyway.
Oppenheimer, who's portrayed in the movie as being so adamantly opposed to the development of hydrogen bombs, when he finds out that the hydrogen bomb is feasible, he says, this is a technically sweet problem and we can't abandon the research. So Oppenheimer is not quite the hero that he's portrayed at times.
Well, this goes back to your point about Szilard, because if Szilard had been more prominently in the film, it would have made Oppenheimer more the bad guy. He would have wound up the bad guy because Szilard, although he was an advocate of using the bomb, you know, when they first thought there was a German plan, before it's dropped on Japan, Szilard and four or five other scientists have this statement, I think it's called the Frank Statement, is it?
Yeah.
Where they call on, absolutely don't use it against Japan, maybe use it on some uninhabited island just to show you got it. But more importantly, start getting ready for negotiations to limit this, because it's only a matter of time till other countries have it. It was a real cautionary statement.
Well, at Chicago and MetLab, they set up a series of committees to investigate different aspects. And the one dealing with the social and political implications of the bomb was headed by the chemist James Frank. And James Frank was very troubled by what they were finding. And he asked who he could see in the government. And he chose to go visit Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace. And but Wallace was really out of the loop at that point. He stayed on after he was dropped as vice president because Roosevelt begged him to. And he was the conscience, and he was the one who was closer to the scientists, but he could not really get to Truman about the bomb decision. So Frank heads this committee, and includes Seaborg, includes Rabinovich and Szilard and top, the really brilliant scientists. And they decide that even if the bomb is ready and usable, we shouldn't use it. It says it's going to lead to an uncontrollable arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union that could lead to World War III and the end of life on the planet. They knew that. Everybody knew the implications. In the movie, they touch on things. So Nolan covers himself without developing. So he can spend 40 minutes developing the Trinity test and the background to that and the experiments and the science. But he spends 40 seconds talking about the opposition to dropping the bomb. And if you know,
which included Eisenhower, right?
Eisenhower was opposed. Yeah. Not only was Eisenhower opposed, seven of America's 8 5-star admirals and generals in 1945 were opposed, either saying it was militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, or both. And that included not only Eisenhower, MacArthur, who wanted to use atomic bombs in the Korean War, and MacArthur, who was such a hawk, said that if we had changed the surrender terms, the Japanese would have happily surrendered in May, months earlier. We could have saved more lives. Admiral Leahy, who was Truman's personal chief of staff, and he chaired the meetings of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Leahy said that this puts us on the level of the barbarians of the Dark Ages. He said there was no justification for dropping the bombs on a thoroughly defeated Japan. He later says there was no excuse from a national defense point of view, no reason for an invasion. We weren't going to invade. They knew that. There was no justification for an invasion. You know, it's a terrible legacy because, as you're saying, the bomb was not dropped on Japan alone. It was dropped in large part to send a message to the Soviet Union of what would happen to the Soviets if they interfered with America's post-war plans in Europe or the Pacific. And the point you're making, we knew the bomb was not necessary. If you look at the meetings of the Joint Intelligence Committee to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I should read you just what they said. The April 11th report says, if at any time the USSR should enter the war, all Japanese will realize that absolute defeat is inevitable. So the two ways are changing surrender terms or waiting for the Soviet invasion. From the day after Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt had implored the Soviets to come into the Pacific War. And then we get much more militarily involved. But throughout most of the war, we weren't. And so Stalin does not, until Yalta in February 45, he then tells Roosevelt that the Soviets will come into the Pacific War 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. The war in Europe ends May 8th. The Soviets will be in August 8th. The Intelligence Committee said that will end the war. The Americans knew that. We've been intercepting the Japanese cables. We've broken their codes. We're intercepting the cables. And they said two things. One, July 12th cable, the only obstacle for peace is the continued demand for unconditional surrender. If they drop the demand for unconditional surrender, we could have peace immediately. Number one, Truman knows that. He reads the Tate cable on July 18th and refers to the intercepted cable as the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. Truman knows they're defeated, and we all knew that. All of his advisors knew that. The second thing is, Truman goes to Potsdam on July 15th, has lunch with Stalin on July 17th. He then writes in his journal, Stalin will be in the Jap War by August 15th. Finney Japs, when that occurs, he knew that was going to end it. It was going to be faster than August 15th. He writes home to his wife, Bess, the next day. The Russians are coming in. We'll end the war a year sooner now. Think of all the kids who won't be killed. He knew that. They all knew the Japanese were defeated. The Japanese themselves knew that. And so at midnight on August 8th, the Soviet Union, on schedule, begins the invasion. And if you look at what forced the Japanese surrender, it was not the atomic bombs. That is the myth. That is the lie that we've been combating, or trying to combat, the lie that the atomic bombs ended the war. It gets repeated all the time. The New York Times just said it a couple days ago. The New York Times wrote, atomic bombs ended World War II. I've got it here. I can find it, the exact quote for you. Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor, had an op-ed in the New York Times in 2019. Quote, following D-Day, my father was sent to the West Coast to prepare for the deployment to the Pacific Theater. He was spared combat by President Harry Truman's decision to drop atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, provoking the Japanese surrender. Bullshit.
It's an essential mythology, because if you actually admit the truth of it, then you're saying that American administration that ended the war are essentially war criminals and ushered us into an era that could end life on Earth.
It undermines the whole myth of American benevolence, American exceptionalism. Well, you start this whole era by dropping two bombs against a defeated country. I was in Hiroshima when Obama finally went there in May of 2016, and he goes in front of the cenotaph, and he says, the World War II reached its brutal end in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Bull, he knows better. Susan Rice knows better. She studied at Stanford. She was a Harry Truman Fellow at Stanford.
That was Peter Kuznick, professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Kuznick is the co-author with Oliver Stone of the Showtime series, The Untold History of the United States. Paul Jay, journalist and filmmaker, had invited him for a discussion about the timely and important film Oppenheimer by Christopher Nolan on his July 27, 2023 podcast on theanalysis.news. This was just a 26-minute excerpt. Please watch the full hour on YouTube under the title Oppenheimer, U.S. Developed First Strike Weapon and Used Japan to Prove It. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.